Jan Morris, Hav. 2006. When Last Letters from Hav was published and nominated for the Booker Prize in 1985, Jan Morris's well-deserved fame as a travel writer and the unfamiliarity of many modern readers with the nature of fiction caused unexpected dismay among travel agents. Their clients demanded to know why they couldn't book a cheap flight to Hav. The problem, of course, was not the destination, but the place of origin. You couldn't get there from London or Moscow, but from Ruritania or Orsinia or the Invisible Cities, it was simply a matter of finding the right train. Now, after 20 years, Jan Morris has returned to Hav, and enhanced, deepened, and marvelously perplexed her guidebook by the addition of a final section called Hav of the Myrmidons. To say that the result isn't what the common reader expects of a novel is not to question its fictionality, which is absolute, or the author's imagination, which is vivid and exact. The story is episodic, entirely lacking in action or plot of the usual sort, but these supposed narrative necessities are fully replaced by the powerful and gathering direction or intention of the whole book. It lacks another supposed necessity of the novel, characters who, while they may represent an abstraction, also take on a memorable existence of their own. Like any good travel writer, Morris talks to interesting people and reports the conversations, and people we met in the first part of the book turn up in the second part to take us about and exhibit in person what has happened to their country. But I confess, I barely remembered their names when I met them again. Morris's gift is not portraiture, and her people are memorable not as individuals but as exemplary Havians. This lack of plot and characters is common in the conventional utopia, and academics and other pigeonholers may stick Hav in with Thomas More and company. That is a respectable slot, but not where the book belongs. Probably Morris, certainly her publisher, will not thank me for saying that, in fact, Hav is science fiction, of a perfectly recognizable type and superb quality. The sciences or areas of expertise involved are social, ethnology, sociology, political science, and above all, history. Hav, the place, exists as a mirror held up to several millennia of pan-Mediterranean history, customs, and politics. It is a focusing mirror. Its intensified reflection sharply concentrates both observation and speculation. Where have we been? Where are we going? Those are the questions the book asks. It poses the questions through the invention of a place not recognized in the atlas or the histories, but which, introduced plausibly and without violence into the existing world, gives us a distanced, ironic, and revelatory view of everything around it. The mode is not satiric fantasy, as with the islands Gulliver visited. It is exuberantly realistic, firmly observant, and genuinely knowledgeable about how things have been and are now in Saudi Arabia or Turkey or Downing Street. Serious science fiction is a mode of realism, not a fantasy. And Hav is a splendid example of the uses of an alternate geography. If, swayed by the silly snobbery of pundits as contemptuous of science fiction as they are ignorant of it, you should turn away from Hav. That's a shame and a loss, very easily prevented, and turned to pure gain by reading the book. It's not an easy book to describe. Hav itself is not easy to describe, as the author frequently laments. As she takes us about with her in her travels of discovery, we grow familiar with the delightful, if somewhat incoherent, Hav of 1985. We climb up to its charming castle, from which the Armenian trumpeter plays at dawn the great lament of Katurian for the knights of the First Crusade, the Chant de douleur pour les pauvres chevaliers qui sont morts. We visit the Venetian Fondaco, the casino, the caliph, the mysterious British agency, the Kretevs, who inhabit caves upon the great escarpment through which the train, Havre's only land link to the rest of Europe, plunges daily down a zigzag tunnel. We see the Iron Dog, we watch the thrilling roof race. But the more we learn, the greater our need to learn more. A sense of things not understood, matters hidden under the surface, begins to loom, even somehow to menace. We have entered a maze, a labyrinth constructed through millennia, leading us back and back to the age of Achilles and the Spartans, who built the canal and set up the Iron Dog at the harbor mouth, and before that to the measureless antiquity of the Kretevs, who are friends of the bear. And the maze stretches out and out too, half around the world, for it seems that Havian poetry was deeply influenced by the Welsh, and just up the coast is the westernmost of all ancient Chinese settlements, which Marco Polo found uninteresting. "There is nothing to be said about Yuan Wen Kuo," he wrote. "Let us now move on to other places." Achilles and Marco Polo aren't the half of it. Ibn Battuta came to Havre, of course, all the great travelers did, and left their comments, diligently quoted by the Havians and Morris. T.E. Lawrence may have discovered a secret mission there. Ernest Hemingway came to fish and to carry off six-toed cats. Havre's glory days of tourism were before the First World War, and again after it, when the train zigzagged through its tunnel laden with the cream of European society, millionaires, and right-wing politicians. But whether or not Hitler was actually there for one night is still a matter of dispute. The politics of Havre itself in 1985 were extremely disputable. Its religions were various, since so many great powers of the East and West had governed it over the centuries. Mosques and churches coexisted amicably. And indeed the spiritual scene was so innocuous as to appear feeble. A small group of hermits, reputed to spend their days in holy meditation, proved to be cheerfully selfish hedonists who simply enjoyed asceticism. And yet, there were the Cathars. Late in her first visit, Morris was taken in darkness and great secrecy to witness a sitting of the Cathars of Havre, a strange ritual conclave of veiled women and cowled men. In some of them, Morris thought she recognized friends, guides, the trumpeter, the tunnel pilot, but she could not be sure. She could not be sure of anything. On her return 20 years later, some things appeared to be all too certain. The old Havre is gone, destroyed in an obscure event called the Intervention. The train is gone. A huge airport is under construction. Ships come in to a destination resort called Lazaretto. The punctuation is part of the name, of the most luxuriously banal kind, where, as a middle-aged lady tourist remarks, one feels so safe. The strange old house of the Chinese master is a burnt ruin. The new landmark is a huge skyscraper called the Myrmidon Tower, a virtuoso display of unashamed, unrestricted, technically unexampled vulgarity. The English legate is at least as sinister and much slimier than his predecessor, the English agent. Most of the city has been rebuilt in concrete. The troglodytic Kretev are housed in hygienic villas, and the bears are extinct. The age of postmodernism has arrived, with its characteristically brutal yet insidious architecture and propaganda, its reductionist culture of advertisement and imitation, its market capitalism, its factionalism and religiosity forever threatening terror. Yet we find pretty soon that Havre is still Havre. The maze, the labyrinth, is still there. Even the elevator of the Myrmidon Tower is indirect. Who, in fact, is running the country? The Cathars. But who are the Cathars? What does the M on the Myrmidon Tower stand for? Jan Morris says in the epilogue that if Havre is an allegory, She's not sure what it is about. I don't take it as an allegory at all. I read it as a brilliant description of the crossroads of the West and East in two recent eras, seen by a woman who has truly seen the world and who lives in it with twice the intensity of most of us. Its enigmas are part of its accuracy. It is a very good guidebook, I think, to the early 21st century.